Masters of Couch Potato Style, Punches and Popcorn.
Welcome to the Double P, Punches and Popcorn, a little martial arts podcast coming out of Rochester, New York, delivering you a healthy dose of history, science, and more on the best damn fight films of all time. We're in our new season, Once Upon a Time in the 80s, where the menu is only the best 80s martial arts movies, and our blue plate special on tap tonight is the Patrick Swayze classic Roadhouse. I'm your host, Michael Huntone, and with me on another ride into the decade of neon and mullets is our genius, Jason Wade Garrett Bills.
Happy to be at the double deuce, boys.
And of course, our own professor, Dr. Dominic Double Deuce DeMore.
The Swayze is in town. The kicks go up and the panties go down. Yeah, I'm pumped.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know how that could be topped. So tonight, Roadhouse is the game, and to do this right, we brought back the best damn comic creator in the business. Three-time Eisner-nominated author and creator of comics such as Sex Castle, Assassination Nation, Six Sidekicks of Trigger Keaton, and Kill 'Em All, Kyle Starks!
That's me. I didn't know we were doing promos. I didn't know we were cutting hot promos.
Hot promos.
Just me. I'm here. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, we're for our longtime listeners, Kyle joined us last year in our first Ninja November. He actually kicked off Ninja November with us for another great 80s film, Enter the Ninja. And tonight, I had to bring Kyle back because I know in our conversations with Kyle, and if you follow Kyle at all on social media, have read his books, you surely know how big Roadhouse is to Kyle as it is to all of us. So, Kyle, I'm glad you're back with us. I'm so excited to talk about this movie with you and with us. But before we can get into this philosophical and fistosophical masterpiece of a film, we need our genius, Jason Bills, to kick us off with some sharp as a broken bottle shard knowledge from the gospel of the guillotine.
You got it, genius.
Genius.
I'm a genius.
He's geniusy.
Wile E. Coyote. Super genius.
Was it you, genius?
You little genius, you.
Being a genius certainly has its advantages.
Alrighty, so I wanted to talk about Joel Silver today. He produced the film. He was kind of a big time, like notorious figure in the 80s and in early 90s. Mega producer. Think about it. It's sad because I'm trying to like draw connections to someone. Like I could say like, oh, he's like Brockheimer in the 90s was Joel Silver in the 80s. But our listeners, maybe they're older, so they would understand that reference. I'm not sure, but that's how I couch that. Basically, we don't talk about producers a lot, so that's why I wanted to focus on him, just also because he's such a colorful character. He didn't really have any Hollywood connections. He started at the bottom like a lot of people do. Was from New Jersey, got a job at a production house when he went to Hollywood called Lawrence Gordon Pictures. His first credit was an associate producer on The Warriors, which I thought was pretty cool. Like that's a pretty great first credit. I hope we talk about that movie together someday. Eventually, kind of once he was up and running, he produced some classics like 48 Hours and Commando. But he also, along with that, came his personality and kind of rubbing people the wrong way. Like he wasn't even allowed to be a part of 48 Hours 2 or another 48 Hours as it's called, which I thought was pretty interesting because the reason why 48 Hours was such a hit were due to a lot of his contributions, like championing Eddie Murphy as the co-lead with Nick Nolte. But then by the late 80s, he sort of like hits his stride. And in 87, he produces Predator and Lethal Weapon, 88 Die Hard, and then in 89 Roadhouse. Like that is like four stone cold classics in a row, like to close out the 80s and kind of cement 80s action cinema. So, you know, he's kind of a big deal to me in terms of being like a movie nerd. Proponent of practical effects and getting it all on camera. He wasn't a big post-production guy. Obviously, I don't even know if that was an option back in the 80s. But, you know, he loved huge explosions. He loved, you know, buddy action movies. He loved cocaine, notorious for that. But again, it was the 80s. That's how you had some fun back then. He was known for discovering talent, like either reinventing careers or inventing careers. Eddie Murphy, Arnold Schwarzenegger, even Steven Seagal. He also championed young filmmakers like Shane Black. He's even produced The Nice Guys, which was like 2016 with Black. So they have a long history together. And then even in the late 90s, he was making contributions like helping the Wachowskis make The Matrix trilogy. So that's a pretty storied career. But I think his biggest contribution is what he did, like making B movies, like big deals, like exploitation concepts. He would give them big budgets. So he'd give your movie an A-level cast, amazing production team, just pouring money and talent on material that wasn't, or that was more frowned upon by like a decade earlier. Like this would just be something you'd see in like, you know, B theaters and stuff like that. Now it's, you know, what you're going to see in your multiplexes. So that's something important to highlight, because it really wasn't like financially viable on like a mega scale until he sort of figured this out. And again, his personality, huge. To wrap this up, he's been parodied in other films like Tom Cruise's character, Les Grossman in Tropic Thunder. That is a based on Joel Silver. And also Saul Rubinek's character in True Romance is another nod to Silver and his cocaine obsession.
Oh, wow.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, pretty cool. And kind of my favorite story about him is he had a notorious feud with Michael Eisner with Disney at the time in the 80s. He was not allowed in the Disney lot, so Robert Zemeckis and Spielberg played a trick on Eisner, or a prank, or a rich people prank, is they cast him as the director in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. In the beginning, the director that is directing Baby Herman in that animated short. He shaved, he put on glasses, totally unrecognizable, so much so that when Eisner finally saw the film, he didn't even register that it was Joel Silver. So I thought that was pretty interesting that they were just like, oh, rich people pranks, this is what we're doing. And then finally, let's actually tie this into the movie we're talking about today. So I want to talk about Silver's contributions for this movie, because they're all pretty great. The director, Rowdy Harrington, really loves Silver. Like, I was listening to the audio commentary, and he's just really big fan of his in terms of what he did for the film. But he would say Joel would come to set with these one-liners, and he'd be like, begrudged to put them in there, but at the same time he's like, okay, well, this guy did give me a shot, so let's do this. So he came to the set one day, and he wasn't saying, oh, try this. He was demanding that the line Sam Elliott puts in about the don't eat the big white mints from the urinal. That's his. And then the ultimate line in the movie was something Silver brought to the set on a random day, which is when Dalton and Jimmy fight, and Jimmy says to Dalton when he rips his head back, I used to fuck guys like you in prison. I just love that he'd just show up like, oh, I thought of this, or maybe he heard it somewhere, but like, this is going in the movie.
It's so good.
Yeah, and Rowdy would say, like, these are the biggest audience reactions. So he's saying, like, in hindsight, these were great additions. And then finally, Kelly Lynch, she has a great story about him. So she meets with him, she gets the part, she's all excited. And so he tells to her in a meeting, he's like, so you're going to be blonde, you're going to have blue eyes, and you're going to be really tan. And so she looks back at Joel and she's like, so Joel, I am already blonde. I already have blue eyes and I already have a tan. And his response to her was, but more. So it's just perfect 80s thing to say.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you think Joel was pitching those lines on other movies that he was producing?
Finally, someone took them.
Guys, I got this prison line. You got to use it. And they're like, Joel, we already have a script. We already have a script for Predator.
I used to fuck guys like you in prison. Come kill me.
I like to imagine he like pitched that. He was like hanging out with Scorsese, and he pitched that while Scorsese was filming Age of Innocence.
It just didn't fit.
Like, yeah, it's not.
What about
not
the Predator
here
saying that? Like, he's fighting Schwarzenegger. That would be great. Finally, he's saying
the Predator is like, explain these white mints to me. I'm like, no, that's convoluted. That's convoluted.
Great stuff.
Yeah, that's good. I didn't know a bunch of that. I love, if you look at Joel Silver's like his film list, it's
nuts.
Yeah, it's wild. You know, I think 48 Hours was Eddie Murphy's first film before he was on Saturday Night Live, I think, too.
Yeah, that was his big
like, which
break,
is,
at least.
Think about that. That's insane. He was like 18. He's like 18 or 19.
And it's just wild that, so we'll get into this movie here in just a second, but the idea that Rowdy Harrington, I think he might have had one movie before this.
Yeah, it was an independent film.
He was a gaffer. Like, he made a jump, and from, I think if I remembered from the commentary, like you were saying, Jay, there really was Joel that thought, like, hey, I think he could helm this, like, he could direct. And, like, people don't generally make that jump directly from, like, if you look at his credits before, he's, like, best boy, grip, gaffer, all that stuff. He's the very technical roles, and he just immediately gets made that jump into a director, and as we'll talk about here, Again, who
yeah, they
else?
Say that like he would do that because, and maybe it's like a little nefarious, but he would have more control over someone new. Like he could kind of like impose his will on them. So, but again, a nice thing to give an up and comer a shot like this. Because
let's talk about it. So our movie tonight, as we said, is 1989's Roadhouse. Is a beer-soaked blast of blues music, muscles, miniskirts, big hair, roundhouse kicks, amateur surgery, and more awesome than seems humanly possible. Put together by the only guy that could have possibly pulled this off, director, who we've just talked about, Rowdy Harrington. But the star of the show, and really one of the biggest stars of the 80s, is Patrick Swayze, whose iconic turn as James Dalton in this film would influence bar security culture worldwide, and his portrayal of the thoughtful warrior would serve as a hero for Generation 6. So let's get into it, guys. Roadhouse. And I'm interested in knowing from, as we kind of talk usually start, you know, where does this movie mean to you? Where did this, like, is this new for you? Did you grow up with this? Kyle, I feel like I need to, you got to go first.
Dude, I love Roadhouse. I think Roadhouse absolutely is probably my four most watched films. I love Roadhouse. I don't know what else to say. Like, we were just talking about, I mean, I know there's a remake, which is not what I want to talk about yet, but we're talking about like people like they did like Clash of the Titans, and there's certain movies don't do it. Like, there's something perfect about them. They're their own thing, and I like the story's not unique at all. Like, but it's kind of a unicorn of action movies, and yeah. It's funny because you'd be like, oh, what are the three? You might have three favorite. It's not number one, but it's probably number two or number three. And I would bet of films that I've watched the most in my life, it's top four for sure. Mm-hmm. Like this and Die Hard, I will watch at any time. At any time, yeah. I'll watch them happily. I adore it. I could make a case that I wouldn't have a comic career if it wasn't for Roadhouse, honestly.
Wow.
Because I remember I did a book called The Legend of Ricky Thunder. I self-published and fell in love with making comics. This is when I was, my daughter was just being born. let's say 13 years ago. So I was 33 or something. And I was like, the next thing I make has to be something I love. So it only made sense that it'd be a love letter to 80s action movies because I love 80s action movies so much. And I remember watching Roadhouse and going in my head, why aren't there more things like this? Why weren't there more Roadhouses? And so I was like, well, I'll just make one, which ended up about halfway through. I go, no, I should just make it the best 80s action movie, which is Sex Castle. I should just make the best 80s action movie never made. And because like I'm going to cast guys that I would like if I was there and if I had a time machine, I was like, guys, I have an idea. But it's such a unicorn. There's nothing like it. There's something about it that's perfect. I don't think you'd change anything. There's subtlety. There's nuance. It's tough when you go, what's the perfect action film? And I'm talking about American action films, obviously, because that's a different beast than if we're talking about something else. But I would say I think Die Hard 3 is maybe the best action movie. I think Commando is the prototype. It's the template for action movies.
Yeah.
But like this and Die Hard are like, they're so good to me. I wouldn't categorize them. They're in their own stratosphere. I adore it. I love one-liners. It has pound for pound more great one-liners than anything else.
Yeah.
I love things that are set someplace bumfuck, honestly, because we're not all from LA or New York. Like most of us are in bumfuck, right? I love that. It's a smart hero. Sure. You know, like the thing Die Hard is like it's kind of an everyman, and Dalton is by no means an everyman, but he has sort of a human fallibility to him. That you have to think kind of drew from from Die Hard a little bit, even though he's not that, right? He's not that, but he is flawed just enough that you just enough that you go, you can kind of relate, but also not at all because he's a killing machine, basically.
Right. You want to think you could relate?
You can aspire. Yeah. He's just, I think he's admirable. Like I would aspire to be like him.
100%. Oh yeah, he's the coolest guy in any action movie who also you want to hang out with. Because anyone, like, name another action star, be like, that's pretty cool, but I don't want to hang out with them. They seem dangerous. Dalton seems like he'd be like, let me tell you the story when I was in anywhere. You're like, tell me what the fuck happened. Like, tell me. And he's like, It's this crazy story. And it involved, a guy with knife hands. And you're like, did he say knife? Did Dalton just say knife hands? This is wild. I'm buying all the rounds tonight. Just hanging out with Dalton. I love it. I would hesitate to say it's my favorite movie of all time, but man, it's close. It's super close.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'd say like if someone put me on the spot, I'd be like, what are you like your favorite? And this is like I love. There's so many guys things that like I love Rear Window. Rear Window might act like I love Rear Window. I'm not. I mean, if you're like I'm gonna put something on, like I'm gonna put it on. Die Hard, Tremors, Roadhouse.
Oh yeah.
And for some reason, Uncle Buck. I'll watch Uncle Buck a thousand times over and over. Oh,
for some reason,
those are probably my four most watched movies, and maybe Rushmore, like Wes Anderson. It's like I just they're comfort food. Like it's
you can't go wrong with any of those.
Anyway, I could talk forever. I love Roadhouse.
Well, we will. That's what we're here to. We are going to talk forever today. But no, I was just rereading Sex Castle. And I mean, you can see the fingerprints of Roadhouse all over it, from the monster truck that you have a great line, one-liner before the monster truck shows up in the book. But you even have a polar bear that leads to the use of the classic, a polar bear fell on me line.
Yeah. Also, the villain's name is Wes Bradley, too.
Right. Like, that's what I was just going to say. Instead of Brad Wesley, it's Wes Bradley.
You know, I love like shouting out stuff like that, but there's like, it's funny because at the time I just thought no one would ever see it. You know what I mean? You're just like dancing in the dark, and it's like, I like these things and I'll do little Easter eggs for these things. But yeah, you think no one's ever gonna see it, but it's it's like, I love Roadhouse, man. I don't know what else to say. Like, I love it. The polar bear thing is like, who's gonna, only a small group of people will notice that. But as is like everyone who reads Sex Castle would notice that. And now I'd probably be smarter about it. Now, you know, many years later, 13 years later or whatever. I'd probably be smarter about it, but not then. He even looks like Brad Wesley.
Oh yeah, very.
He even looks like, I just drew him.
He does. Oh, we'll get into all this and more for sure. Dom and Jay, how about you guys? Where does Roadhouse sit for you?
So this movie, like, I think, you know, it's nice hearing the history and the Joel Silver part, because I do find this movie to be an exploitation movie dressed like a blockbuster, and it's not a criticism at all. You know, it's funny, actually, I read the review that was written by Roger Ebert when it came out, and I thought it was interesting what he said, because he goes, Roadhouse exists right on the edge between a good bad movie and merely bad. I hesitate to recommend it because it so much depends on the ironic vision of the viewer. This is not a good movie, but viewed in the right frame of mind, it's not a boring one either. And I feel like that review hasn't aged well, because at the time it came out, this had a lot of exploitation things that were considered to be, I don't know what's the word I'm looking for, base or cheap or lazy or whatever. But now that the 80s generation has grown up, we're like, these things were genius, and we think they're great. So like, I see where they were coming from back then, but the critics had a lack of foresight, because these things are good and they have aged so well, and this movie has aged very well. And it also has such charm to it. Like the female lead, like, she does not have to be that tan. She does not have to be that blonde. Like, she doesn't. Like, I thought this when I was young, and I still think it now. She looks like a doctor in a porno. Like, she comes out in her cute little outfit and her two big glasses and her coat, and she's like, so why are you here today? And I'm like, yeah, this, you know, but it's great. Who cares? You know? And the one-liners are awesome. This is like, you know, this movie was actually nominated for Golden Raspberry.
Yeah, bullshit. Garbage. Can you imagine watching this movie and going, this is
I like a lot of the Golden Raspberry movies. They're very like Showgirls isn't like a piece of trash I'll never watch. God. Like, I think it's a pretty solid movie.
So entertaining.
Yeah, like, it has its place. So, like, I feel like this movie aged. It was good then, and it wasn't appreciated by the you know, the top tier critics. But I feel like nowadays this kind of movie is considered gold. And I agree. I think it's gold. Also, it has Patrick Swayze, who, like, rest in peace, man.
Yeah.
Like, I miss him. Like, the 80s produced so many action stars that were like, you never made a copy of. Like, I feel like, first of all, I haven't seen a Bruce Willis since Bruce Willis, you know, in Die Hard. Arnold has yet to be replicated. Like, we haven't replicated Arnold. And Patrick Swayze. Who's Patrick Swayze nowadays? Who has the charm, the looks, the athleticism, the any of that stuff? Like,
well, Jake Gyllenhaal's going to try to be.
It's interesting because the 80s, it did have Sly.
Yeah.
There's a whole JCBD. Yes. Stevens, like, there's a cat, and each one was unique, and they kind of had that prior where it was like Bronson and Norris. Like, you had it, but it wasn't like they hadn't figured out how to be. No one gave a shit. There wasn't enough money to have like charming people do it. People with charisma, and somehow in the 80s is like And but it was like, yes, an Avengers team, which again is like in Sex Castle, I was like, I'm just gonna put everyone in it. I love them. But it's like that cast. And the thing is, it's tough to be like, to compare now 30 years later, because with the Marvel movies, they're not any version of themselves, right? Those are the action movies now. So they're kind of like think about like Scott Atkins. Like there's kind of guys that you go, this could kind of maybe be it. This could kind of maybe be it. And I think like Korean films have that, where it's like, I want to see this guy, I want to see this guy. But there's a weird thing. It's like, you know, action movies just fell out so poorly for so many years that we lost that. But it is interesting to think, like, even from like a movie making standpoint, I'll tangent a little bit. But to your point is to go, all right, we got the script. It's an action movie in space. It's like, all right, well, who's the main character? What's he like? And it's like, no, who are we casting?
Right.
Like, don't write that character.
Right.
Like, well, who's available that we could get? Because that's going to decide. And like, think of the exercise of that. Because someone is like, I've made this story. And they're like, well, we're putting Arnold in it. So it's like, that's all different now. Right. We're going to put Bruce in it. And the thing is, like, those guys had so much.
To bounce back on that, Terminator, how iconic is Terminator? Terminator is arguably the most iconic action movie. That movie was written entirely different because they were going to cast Lance Hendrickson as the Terminator and Arnold as Kyle Reese, and they wanted the Terminator to be more like a sneaky, stealthy robot. And then Arnold's like, I be the Terminator? And the Terminator is now this walking, killing machine that is very ominous and very imposing. Right. It entirely changed the movie. I think it'd be interesting to see a Terminator like the original Vision, but it would have been totally different. Because they did exactly what you just said, Kyle. They said, if we make Arnold the Terminator, we got to change everything. And they did, and it was awesome. And I think you're right. Yep. Now I think they're these cookie-cutter roles.
Jay, how about you? I don't want to move past without getting your history with Roadhouse.
Yeah, no, I did not see this in theater. It's interesting, and this is something I miss, is it sort of was like forced upon me, but not like it was just on TNT or USA like for most of my teenage years. And I kind of miss that. Like this, a movie becomes like, or a cult movie becomes forced upon you. Like now, like kids, like they're just on Netflix or Hulu, whatever, Disney Plus, like you pick what you want. But back in the day, you were kind of forced, like maybe I didn't want to watch Roadhouse that day, but I was going to watch it because it was on TNT.
There's nothing else on.
Exactly. And I kind of missed that culture where it was just on all the time. And eventually I was just totally on board. And how could you not be? But it's just, I kind of missed that. Like, okay, it's Sunday at noon and football hasn't started yet. Like Roadhouse is on USA Network. Like, I just love that. And this is just such an important formative movie for me too. Is like you guys.
Imagine then you saw the uncensored version. You're like, there's so many tits in this. I like Fast Times at Ridgemont High. I never saw the uncensored version for probably like 20 years. And then I saw it. I'm like, what the hell is happening? Like,
what's going on?
Right.
What the
hell? Honestly, that was my experience. So I was like, oh yeah, I know Roadhouse. I've seen it a bunch of times because similar when it's on TV, even now, like, but I don't think I ever watched it all unedited just in one sit until I got the disc and to prepare for this recording that I sat down and watched the whole movie. I'm like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And I just I remember in our Slack chat, I like posted immediately. I was like, guys, holy crap, I can't wait to talk about this. This is the greatest movie ever. Like, it's just, I knew the parts, the bits, I knew Dalton, the lines, but it was like seeing everything and then, but more. When it's unedited was just, it was wild. So I don't want to delay anymore. Let's start jumping into our story. So I'll get us into it. This movie begins where we meet the king of cool, the one and only Dalton, who's calm, smiling, and nodding undersized persona that hides an epic level of badassery. We see right away that earns him the job offer that sets our story in motion.
Can I throw out an interesting factoid at the beginning when
when
Double Deuce Guy goes to who knows where to get Dalton? The band do you guys know this already? The band that's playing it's the same lead singer as the band that's playing at the Titty Twister and From Dust
Tito and the Tarantula.
Can we propose? Yes. Can we propose it's a shared universe? Yes. Is it possible?
Oh, it 100% is.
It's a shared
Roadhouse
universe.
Exists.
There's vampires.
Oh, so there's vampires.
The Brothers. Come on.
See, now that
Let's put it
now
together.
That you're saying that, now I wish this remake that's coming out was done by Robert Rodriguez, because then I feel like it would actually be awesome. I mean, think about this. Let's set this in time now. This is 1989, and Patrick Swayze, he has just come off the, you know, really the thing that launched his career, Dirty Dancing. Of course, he had Red Dawn before it, a few other things. But imagine at this time, you're a girl in the 80s, and you love Dirty Dancing. This is your favorite movie. You've just seen Cocktail, and you're like, oh, Patrick Swayze is in this bar movie. This is going to be like Dirty Dancing and Cocktail combined. And then you meet Dalton. Like, what was that like?
I was kind of blown away that this would be like his pick for his follow-up to Dirty Dancing. You'd think he'd want to like lean into more, you know, Dirty Dancing style things. And I forget where I read it, but it was very, he did this because of Dirty Dancing. Like, he wanted to show a more kind of like dangerous side of his physicality, because he, you know, trained in martial arts and very physical actors. So like, once I heard that, I was like, oh, this was because of Dirty Dancing. Like, this is why he wanted to do something more masculine and physical.
If you look at his career, it's super varied. It doesn't make much sense. Yeah. He's never bad in anything. Right. His role in Donnie Darko is crazy. Oh, yeah. Like, it's a crazy, like, pre-Tom Cruise and Magnolia sort of role.
Speaking of, like, women watching this movie, my wife never saw it. She's a little bit younger than us, so she hasn't seen a lot of 80s movies, and she absolutely loves 80s movies for someone that never really watched them. And, like, she saw Gremlins, and she's like, 5 out of 5 stars. This movie's amazing. Mm-hmm. So she loves 80s movies. Yes. So I'm like,
that's the correct rating.
I'm like, you should watch Roadhouse with me. And she's like, okay. And she's like, is it an 80s movie? And I go, yes. She's like, how 80s is it? And I'm like, very, very 80s.
And the most 80s.
And she loved
all
it.
Of the 80s.
Someone's doing jazzercise.
She's like, so not to jump around in the movie, but she's like, you know, they have the outlandish looking fashion, of course, on the women. They have the over-the-top one-liners. She's like, the romance scenes are drawn out and overly passionate. In fact, during the sex scene, she starts humming, and I'm like, wow, you are an 80s child. You know, it's great. It hits all the beats. Like, and so, like, I think this is, I don't want to say female friendly. That sounds very pejorative. But like, it seems like, I feel like,
I don't know what it is.
I don't think the stereotypical 80s woman would be like, I hate this movie. Oh yeah.
I think it's better than like a Schwarzenegger. If you were like, which also always has a female lead, you know, co-lead, but they're very wooden, and Doc is super wooden. Let's not. And she's objectified through the whole thing, but hey, she's smart, guys.
She's a doctor.
There's only two women. There's three women. One gets beat. All right. One gets beaten and shows everything. And her awesome 80s panties. There's Doc, who is, if Doc wasn't in it, it wouldn't change anything, which is a weird, as far as looking at this movie from a feminist point of view. And the other one is the bar girl, who's very charming. I didn't know she could sing. And he's like, she can't, which is like a weird bit. Like, there's only three women in the whole thing. And like, none of them are, they're just there. You
right.
Know what I
well,
mean?
And so, the bar girl, the singing bar girl who, I forget the actress's name, but she actually like released albums
She's
after
great.
That. But she kind of she kind of disappears from the movie after that. Like, cause they set her up. Like, she brings the breakfast to him, and you're like, oh, she's
for
like
no
his
reason.
Best buddy. And then
they just
she pretty
an
much disappears
for someone
from the movie.
To gawk at his ass. Cause that's what happens.
No, for sure. And you need, she plays that role of like, so she's the person, cause you can't have the bar guy going, you guys haven't heard about Dalton. So there's someone in the bar besides Cody who is like, because Cody isn't with the bar. He's his own entity, right? Cody's Jeff Healy, blind Jeff Healy. Yeah. But her role is to be like, I've heard of this guy. And they're like, oh, he must be somebody. That's literally her role, is to hype him up.
Right.
And then as pretty solid exposition, but how did she get in his place?
Right. He lives in a bar. He literally was raised in a bar.
I guess that's true.
Right. So we meet Dalton again. He gets his job, and quickly we get to Jasper. You know, Dalton arrives in the Fairburg of Jasper, and we're introduced to what is really what we've been talking about here, the diviest of dive bars, the Double Deuce, a hive of scum and villainy that needs a cage around the stage to protect the bar band, drug deals in the bathroom, pimping at the tables, and beer bottles flying everywhere.
That really made an impression on me when I was a kid, the cage around the band. Like, you could just throw beer bottles at him, and that's just going to protect you from the glass.
Yeah, the Blues Brothers, the Blues Brothers have it, too. So there's something, one of the things I love, and I'm going to probably keep coming back, is that Roadhouse as a story, as being told as a story, it does a lot of very nuanced things that are, like, shorthand. So the chicken wire is one, it must be a rough place. As you walk into the Double Deuce, there's a guy dancing on the floor with no shirt. What I mean? Like, oh, they don't, no shirts, no shoes, no service. Like, they're not even wearing shirts in this crazy fucker. And another like shorthand thing that it does is, you know, Dalton walks in. He's casing the joint. He's cool. He's the coolest.
Just nodding away.
And he walks to the bar. He walks to the bar, and there's a guy at the bar. No one cares because it's the wildest place. It's out of control. These are wild animals, right? But there's one guy at the bar who's super drunk, and he looks at Dalton. And has the cosmic awareness to be like, I should probably get the fuck
out.
And he just walks off, he leaves. And it's such a great, like, one, this place is wild. Dalton has something that affects weaker men. There's something about him that if you are prey, if you have prey sense, it goes off when you see him. And it's little stuff like that. And they do it through the whole thing. And it's a tough thing to do because you have to commit to the nuance of it. I'll jump ahead a little bit. There's a bit where, like, when Dalton goes to see Bradley, and he's like, oh, who's this guy in this picture? And he's like, that's my grandpa. And he goes, he seems like an important guy. And he's like, he's an asshole. That's a throwaway scene. But it, you know what it tells you? It says this Wesley comes from a descending line of people who are abusers and evil. Little stuff like that. So like a guy with no shirt, the chicken wire. And they do it over and over. They don't go, hey, look, there's chicken wire.
Right.
Hey, look. They never say, hey, look. They let you learn by seeing. And that's part of why this show's so magical is because it takes they do both. It's very nuanced. But also they're like, look at this girl striptease dance just to show you this guy. It doesn't make any sense. You know what I mean?
Right.
So yeah, the guy with no shirt, and then the other guy's like, I'm out. I'm never coming back to the again.
I'm done.
As long as this guy's here, we're all in trouble. I love it.
Yeah, and you're right. Once you see the chicken wire on the stage, you immediately know what kind of bar this is, right? And I love that right away we get to see who's the head bouncer at the time. The character's name is Morgan.
Yes, we love
it. His name in the movie isn't important. His real name is what's important, and he is the one and only legendary, one of the greatest professional wrestlers of all time, Terry Funk.
Who was the stunt coordinator,
too. Was.
You guys, dude, Terry, every fight you see, Terry Funk, he was the coordinator for it. He choreographed all those fights. That's why they're so different. They look like real fights. Like, where they don't look like Kung Fu. Right. I mean, some of it does, but, like, there's a bit when... when Tinker and the big guy who looks like a rock face. By the way, Bradley hired like the most rock face looking dudes. They're like the craziest looking dudes.
They're the gooniest of goons.
Tinker and this guy, they're all like brickheads. You know what I mean? Like they're the craziest heads. But they had that fight where Dalton and the other guy like roll out the window and then they hit the outside. Then they hit the rail and they roll out again onto a table. And you're like, it doesn't look like another movie. And it's because they had this guy who knew how to fight, basically doing it.
Yeah, I'd like to comment on that. I found that, I know they wanted to say that Dalton was like this very sophisticated martial artist. That was the impression. But I noticed the fighting was very rough and tumble. You know, it was a lot of haymakers. Yeah. It was a lot of like... Yeah. Sidekick, not roundhouse kicks, sidekicks. Like it did have this WWE, the way a big showy guy would fight, lots of force, lots of like impact fighting, lots of dramatic swings. It had that, it had not a cinematic flair, but that it, so sorry for anyone who
knows. No, it's real and it's dirty. It's real and it's dirty.
Yeah, it's real and it's dirty. And it's WWE style before WWE. It has that professional wrestling like theatricality to it. Not a kung fu movie theatricality.
No, there's one kung fu fight, right? There's one kung fu fight at the end.
Yeah.
And Dalton will throw a spinning kick every now and then.
Right.
That's it. Otherwise, it's just dudes fighting.
Yeah.
I love that.
Well, that's what I love.
It's very WWE.
And what I think Terry Funk brings into it is, you know, one of the things we talk about, one of the things that was huge in the 80s was WWF at the time. And the way that he fights and brawls is so, and you're right, that's like the fights here, was so representative of what WWF was at the time. You know, when it was just these big, beefy guys that are just slamming people around, throwing them around, just this, you know, brute physicality. And, you know, and Funk brings it. It's genius to have a professional wrestler, especially one as legendary as Terry Funk, because this is what he does, right? He performs and puts on a show, and right away, and right, like, his physicality and the way that he runs the bar, you know, runs, I guess, quote unquote security at the Double Deuce. So it shows us that just as much as the chicken wire shows us exactly what kind of place this is, right?
He has a couple great lines in the open, but one is like the two guys start fighting over a pool, and the guy's like, hey, Morgan. He's like, ah, they're brothers. I can't remember because his lines, it's a good, like, it's not, I thought you'd be bigger. He has some great line to Dalton, and it's a great line. It's a great one-liner. But one of the liners that I always take is that Dalton looks at him so cool and just says, opinions vary. And I love that.
Yeah.
He does not care about you.
Right.
He cares about one thing, and that's doing this one job. Does he care about art? Does he want to go see a movie? Do you want to go? No. He only cares about this one thing. You can't knock him off of it. You can't distract him from it. And he does that over and over because he's so cool. He's zen. He's not worried about your shit. He's just doing the thing he wants to do. Opinions vary. It's such a good one. And he followed, like, they do a lesser version of that one where he's like, what do they call my mom, a whore? And he goes, well, is she? And it's the same thing, but different, right? It's so like that good. Opinions vary is so, it's such a chill response. Oh, yeah. That's like the action movie equivalent of Pee Wee Herman's I Know I Am, What Are You? It's like the most
right.
of that. Opinions vary, man.
Right.
I don't know what to tell you. You can have that. It's fine.
Right. Well, and that's what we see. So when we get.
Hey, I was going to say also, hold on. I was going to say in this opening sequence, also for how tough this bar is, and I never noticed it. Again, I watched this movie 1,000 times before on this, so I'm taking notes. Is there's an early. When Terry Funk throws a guy out, and then the next, he throws him onto a table. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Like,
and when he lands on the table and comes up, his ass is on fire from the cigarette ashtray, and he's literally wiping smoke.
I never noticed it either.
He's literally wiping smoke and ash off of his butt. And it's such a great scene because, like, that's like, you wouldn't, like, we watched this movie a million times. I never noticed it before, but I've always saw it, right? You always go, this place is rough. This place is rough. Yeah, dude's butt was on fire. Insane.
This is also, let's keep in mind, at this bar, too, we have, like, men pimping out their wives and girlfriends for $20.
You just cop a feel for funsies. That guy's face when he's like, I don't have $20.
That was hysterical.
So insane. He's like the most crazy eyes. And then also all the crime, like all the awful crime happening inside the Double Deuce is like on paper bad, but seeing it, you're kind of like, it seems funny. It seems okay.
Right.
Like, it doesn't actually seem that bad.
Anything goes.
Right. Yeah, I agree. It is a bar. It's not a school.
Right. Well, when it's Dalton's turn to finally take control of the Double Deuce, he lays down the law quickly, as we see, and he cleans house so fast he makes John Tapper blush, dictating Dalton's law and philosophy that will turn this bar around and fast. So I love we get this moment, again, which to me is like one of the best introductions to a character, you know, how I introduced you, Kyle, and like is how I would want, like, in my dreams to be introduced, you know, when Tillman is just like, I want to protect my investment and I've hired the best damn cooler in the business. It just sounds so damn cool.
Such a good term.
And then he lays down the law. We get really our first look into the philosophy of Dalton. Like, we've seen him walk the walk before this, and now he explains how he's going to.
Has he had a fight at this point? I don't think he has.
No, because that one guy in the beginning challenges him, and he gets him outside of the bar, and he walks.
Well, and he gets stabbed, or he gets cut.
He's still great.
That's the first time we see him stitch himself up.
That's right.
Like, but he's not really fighting him. It's just that guy.
No, so he hasn't even thrown a fist yet. It's such a masterclass of introduction because, like, the character. Like, listen, guys, the one we've placed rules. We put rules in place, which is always good to set the consumer up for what can happen down the line. And you're like, what do we know? He's presumably tough. He must be tough because he doesn't care, right? Which is like, it's like being cool in high school, right? As long as you're immune and don't care. But we haven't seen him throw a punch yet. And he's just slinging guys out. He's throwing everybody out.
Right, like first thing he does is fire Terry Funk.
Well, I mean, there's the guy. So like, there's so many crimes though. Yeah. There's so many crimes. Like there's the one guy who's stealing. That guy is, you know, what is his name? I keep thinking he's Jackie Treehorn. I'm sorry.
Brad Wesley.
Oh, Ben Gazzara.
Wesley?
Yeah.
Who, by the way, plays Jackie Treehorn in...
I'm convinced this is Jackie Treehorn's origin story.
Same guy. Why not? Yeah, why not? Shared universe, number three.
Well, here's another shared universe, quickly, is because of his, like, Zen philosophy, I often think of Dalton as, like, this was before he was Brody in Point Break, like, because he just has all that
Zen
philosophy and like, I want you to be nice until it's not time to be nice, or whatever that line is. Just like, oh, this is very Brody-esque.
But anyway, back to my point, you have to clean out the bar. You got the one guy who's stealing, who's part of the head family. You got the other guy who's hooking up in the storage room. You know, you're going to be my Saturday regular. You got the woman dealing drugs. You got the bouncer who is just antagonizing people, which is totally contradictory Swayze's philosophy of like, he's like, you got to be nice. He's like, and basically what he's saying, he's like, you're fired because you make it worse. Yeah. He's like, you know, if the goal is to stop people from making a scene and making a mess, you being an asshole isn't helping. And it makes a lot of sense. And clearly, like, and that's why he buys that like clunker car, is because he knows that it's going to get trashed.
One interesting thing I noticed, which I'd never noticed before, when he goes to buy that clunker of a car, in the back of that office, he has a sign that says Jasper Improvement Society, which makes me think the reason why we don't see this businessman later, the used car guy, is because he's in with Wesley. He has the sign, like he's paying his dues or doing whatever you have to do to not get hit. And I looked, is it in Red's? Red doesn't have it. Is it in the car dealership? I didn't see it. So I think it's a very subtle little thing, which maybe they filmed it in Jasper and it just happened.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, it might just be, but it's like, oh, that's interesting, because you never see that guy again. He's not a part of, you know what I mean? He's not involved. I love that shitty car. I love him getting tired. That's, again, it's a nuanced thing to go where you go, he's not concerned. He has a plan. He knows you fuck his car. He doesn't care. He doesn't care.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's so nuanced, man. It just show don't tell.
Well, and it's cool, because I remember, you know, rewatching it at the beginning when he gets the job offer. Then I remember watching the movie, like, what the hell happened here? He parks by the garage and just throws his key to the guy hanging out and is like, it's yours now. And it's more, we then see the Mercedes and we're like, oh, wow, he has a Mercedes. I didn't expect that. And then he buys his car in the wheels. You're like, what's that about? And of course, then it all makes sense. Like,
He's done it before.
Right.
He's been here. They throw a stop sign through his window at one point. How do you think of the stop sign out of the ground? Much less put it through his car.
Right.
Also, can I bring up another 80s trope that this movie does really well? No police. But yet they show up at the very end of the movie, and I'm like, oh my God, this is the best 80s trope.
I love it.
So two things I want to point out. One, Dom, you mentioned the guy banging the girl in the back room, who, if you like rewatch it, they sort of imply that like she's a teenager, possibly.
Yeah.
Because
is she the same one you see later?
I think she is. Girl? The one that like the guy, the door guy, is like, the Sears card won't work here. And right. But I didn't notice this, or I didn't think about this until I was watching one of the great commentaries of this movie is with Kevin Smith, and I forget who else is on it. And like, they're just talking about it. And he points out that like, this guy has stripped fully naked to like, she is not naked.
And
I was like, what, he needed to take everything off to do this? Like,
no. Because he's a psychopath. That's why. You can look at that guy and know that when he goes to go pee in a urinal, all the way down, the pants go all the way fucking down.
Exactly.
You're like, what is this psychopath?
Right.
This guy is a problem. He's a menace to society.
So this whole the scene of the where he lays down the law, like watching this now after having seen umpteen million episodes of Bar Rescue, like it never was so obvious to me that like Bar Rescue totally steals the, I mean, even where like, if you watch it, it's usually Tapper is there first and he's watching and they point out, they're like, oh, look who's like over pouring drinks, who's stealing this and that. And then Tapper has the scene where it's all the staff there and he just starts like, first thing he does, fire, you know, person A, B, and C, and you know, they grumble and get out of there, and then okay, this is how we're gonna do it. And like, I would say that like, this is like a long version of Bar Rescue, but that would be insulting to Roadhouse. Clearly Bar Rescue is, we want to pretend to be Roadhouse every episode. So
do you think the last one Dalton goes, and your menu has too many items?
that's one of the cutscenes we didn't get.
And they're like, are we serving food here? What the hell, Dalton?
Right. Well,
at the end of that, what I thought, a little note, is that if you rewatch it again, and everyone at home will be, is that at the end of that night, the band has so many girls around him. There's like 15 girls around like four dudes. And you're like, this band's pretty good. But imagine like Jeff Healey playing every night in bumfuck Missouri or wherever it is. They'd be like, this blind dude's fucking good. Have you seen him? He's like, no, I don't go there. I don't go there. They're like, well, all my girlfriends are going because they like him a lot. They think they're going to be big
ones. Right, right.
They will be. Also, Swayze plays a prank on him. Like, what a mean.
Yes.
I wonder how, like, that's a good, how does Jeff Healey get in this movie? How does he get lines?
Yeah.
Because I think he's in one other movie where he has lines. I could be wrong about that. I haven't looked, but I remember.
I can't remember if it was Joel Silver or Rowdy. One of the special features that I watched said that, like, literally, they just saw this guy and were like, this guy's great, and he is exactly what we need for this movie.
Yeah.
But why does he get lines? Perfect. And some of his lines are so perplexing. I hate jumping around, but this is the second time someone says to Dalton, I thought you'd be bigger. Which you're blind. I mean, I'm not shaming or whatever. But like, but anyway, so it's a funny bit, and they use it a couple times, and I'll have a callback to that later. But also, the first fight, the first night, we're like, he just says, the name's Dalton. And I know we're supposed to think that everyone in the bar is like, who is that? But why didn't they have a scene where everyone in the bar is going, who is that?
Right.
Who is that? And then he's like, the name's Dalton. It just seems like the weird blues guy is saying, a non sequitur.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense. The name
right. Dalton. Yeah, it's just apparently his legend. All right. So, let's move more into this. As Dalton settles into his new home, we get to meet more of this memorable cast of characters that make Jasper the best and worst place around, including Dalton's soon-to-be new BFF, Red Webster, his own quasi-new father figure in the landlord, Emmett, and, of course, the villain that we've been mentioning here. We finally see him. Brad Wesley.
Oh, he's a trouble.
Or swerving his car. Remember that scene?
Yeah,
like,
what
that
was
scene
that?
Was totally unnecessary, but it was great.
Yeah.
That Emmett, when he meets Emmett to go get the bar, and it's one of my favorite things. First of all, I'd like to do, you guys know Emmett's in Tremors too.
Oh,
so there's like
yes.
a direct line between, he plays the guy who dies in the electric, you only see him dead body in an electric tower. Also, his name is Sunshine Parker, which is great. Another great line, and I'm going to do this repeatedly, but is when he's like, why would you take this place? Like, there's no air conditioning, there's no TV, it sucks, it smells like horse crap. And Dalton's like, he just sold it too well.
Yeah, he's like,
you're too damn persuasive. It's such a good bit.
Yeah.
Emmett's great. That scene, you only see Emmett like really one more time in one of the dumbest. Like, I love it, and we get to it, but. Like, you just see him this one bit where it's just like, hey, it really serves more of a function of going, look, the town's full of likable people. Like, that's really the function of it, right? Which, again, it's so smart. But that in exchange, just that exchange, like, are you an honest guy? Yes. You wouldn't be lying to me, would you? Like, it's such clever dialogue that just keeps telling you more. Like, everything in Roadhouse serves a function.
Yeah.
And I love that. Like, that's something that I do in my writing. There's no throwaway bits. Even if you just have a conversation, tell me something about the character. Tell me about something about intent. Tell me about location, right? Because location kind of matters, though it doesn't. But they introduce Wesley. Yep. It's so smart, man. Little things like that smart. Like Red doesn't do anything. Red just shows the town gets harassed. That's all he does.
Right.
You know what I mean? And he's Doc's dad.
Uncle.
But he doesn't, like, that's just, he's just there to be a MacGuffin in many ways. But Emmett, that exchange is, all of that whole exchange is just like a wonderful snapshot of dialogue.
Yeah.
Yeah, the movie's so loaded with great, like, side characters. Like, I'm just blown away. Like, you have to imagine that there was more in the movie about these specific characters. Like, I guess the rough cut was, like, 3.5 hours long.
Really?
It's so much so that one of the big B-plots that went out was the new bartender, the black bartender, is actually played by, and I didn't know this until I was watching the special features, is Keith David.
Yeah.
What?
Who?
He has, like,
yeah,
one
I know,
line
like,
in the
black
movie.
Bartender who you just kind of see.
He has one line.
He has a whole...
We're running out of whiskey.
A whole, like,
we're running out of whiskey. We're running low on
that's
whiskey.
It.
That's his line. We're running
Keith
low on whiskey.
That's Keith David. It is just like, what? And so we had a whole subplot with him and Dalton bonding about him coming to town and blah, blah, blah. But they cut it out because they had to, you know, make it a not 3.5 hour
they
movie.
Go, they go on like, vacation oh together. God. They fight some aliens.
right.
Wait,
yeah.
Oh, my God.
It just blows me away that,
I mean, this is definitely, you know, almost a decade after The Thing has come out. Obviously, Platoon has come out. Like, it's not like he was a known actor. And I mean,
his name's is in the credits prominently too. Like,
that's so funny because I was watching it today and I never noticed the replacement bartender. And I did think he looked familiar, but he's only got one line. I didn't even bother. I never knew that.
Then once you know it's him and you like listen to that line, like the second he has such a distinctive voice, right? That you're like, oh, that's Keith David.
Can we talk about the transition of the bar? Like Keith David being hired is only one of many transitions. They all got matching red shirts. It looks like a TGI Fridays now. Like, like there are people who dress nice. The floor probably isn't the same.
No, new floor, new everything. You know. No, I know we're jumping ahead, but again, with the like show don't tell, the chicken wire's gone. It's a new bar. Yes. Like it's everyone has shirts on
and like shirts and ties. Yeah. Like that's you just notice like the class of customer changes dramatically. And you're right. It's just by showing the wires down and showing these, you're like, oh wow, this
the new sign.
Oh painted. Yeah, that's just gorgeous. I love that side. You know, but again, all this doesn't happen easily. Wesley won't be denied without a few more bumps, bruises, and slashes. And even though we've seen Dalton capable of sewing his own wounds, some cuts require more work, which fortunately for Dalton, introduces him to the good doctor, Doc Elizabeth Clay, and gives us the opportunity to hear one of the most iconic lines in this film.
The doc scene's great, because again, it's the... In case you... They were too nuanced in describing this character. This is the moment where they go. But I'm going to tell you again, something I noticed during my notes. When you first see the doctor's office, there's an old man coming from left to right who's carrying a little thing of urine and he's shaking. this little like Dixie cup of urine. It's the greatest fucking thing, man.
So great.
Oh, yeah.
Pain don't hurt. It's just weakness leaving the body. And the doctor's like, okay. Like, is that what you said? Is that okay?
Right. When we get these other details, right? Like he just carries his medical records around with him. That's when we find out
he's ready for everything.
Right.
Saves time. Mm-hmm. And he got a degree in philosophy.
He's ready for everything. He can't be shaken. Which is the whole thing is like this. What happens as the story goes on actually shakes him.
Right.
Doing air quotes because it. It seems like probably another just week for Dalton, if I'm going to be honest with you. He seems upset about it, but because Doc's so hot. dude, I love that scene. I love Pain Don't Hurt became like sort of a catchphrase for tough guys. Like if you knew any guys who were 20 when Roadhouse came out and they saw themselves tough in any way, they'd be like, Pain Don't Hurt. I'm like, you know what though? It does. Like I see what you're saying, but guess what?
Right.
Wrong. Unless you have some sort of neural, like, nervous system. You know what I mean?
There's a science segment.
Oh, there you go.
Does pain actually hurt?
Oh, that's great.
You know, it's funny. I don't want to get hurt, but we were talking about, because they're lazy, and I was like, don't do that one. Don't ruin, I don't want to know if it does or doesn't for some people, because it's such a good line. It's like, pain doesn't hurt for him. You know what I mean? Like, that's the...
Which is whether, why he doesn't so need like, anesthesia?
No. Here's the thing. It does hurt, but he's like, he can't be shaken. Like, it's not that he's immune to pain. That's not his character. It's just that he's unflappable. Yep. And that's what all of this is. He's very zen. Yep. He's unflappable. It's not that pain doesn't hurt. He has a philosophy for it. Yeah. You know what I mean? Everything he has a philosophy
for.
Well, I think there's actually another thing to it, too, as well. I think when you say to a sexy woman who's tending to your wounds that pain doesn't hurt, it's almost like he's saying pain doesn't hurt, but... my heart can be broken, which they come to later when Sam Elliott's like, you want to see a real scar? And he shows them this scar that it looked like an appendectomy. Yeah. And she's like, what is that, a woman? And he's like, yeah, you know, it's like there's this thing like, you can't hurt me physically, but you can hurt me emotionally because I'm sensitive. I'm handsome. I can kick ass, but I'm sensitive.
Oh, yeah.
All the women go,
you study philosophy. You what's know? More sensitive?
Right, exactly.
Than that?
Exactly.
The editing on that Wade Garrett, when he starts to unzip his pants, they cut back to Doc, and she's like, what? She's like doing like a tech, or Avery fucking Wolf thing, and then they cut back to his like, and they're like, what? Like, what is this edit? What was Rowdy thinking? Like, is it like Doc's yes, she's a doctor and she's educated, but she's cool. She's down to party. Like, Wade's about to show you his penis, dude. Like, don't be so excited. Like, it's a weird scene. It's a weird man. It's such a weird edit.
Guys, this is a great point for us. Let's take a break. We'll bring it back and continue on in this incredible story.
Hey, it's Dario.
And Chris.
Of Refined Taste Podcast here on the Lunchador Podcast Network. Are you a Rochester foodie or a fan of hilarity? If you answered yes to either or both of those questions, Refined Taste is for you.
Every episode, we talk with representatives of Rochester's food and beverage scene, tell their stories, and have plenty of fun and laughs along the way.
We'd be honored if you checked it out. New episodes drop every Wednesday.
Welcome back to another episode of Punches and Popcorn, and we are at the Double Deuce breaking down Roadhouse with our special guest, Kyle Starks. Again, Kyle, thank you for joining us and talking about this incredible film. We've already covered so much ground, and we've got so much more to go. So let's take back before break, we were talking about the doc, and we see as we're coming back in this masterwork of a film, we see that Brad Wesley, who is really ticked that Dalton is in this town. In spite of his best efforts to run Dalton out of town, our hero is settled in, and he's settling down with the good doc, who apparently had a previous thing with Brad Wesley. And this guy, Brad Wesley,
he
gets to watch some really heavy action across the way from his house, really like from his own front porch. So,
all right, so let's talk about the sex scene real fast. I have a couple questions. One. Number one, do you think the line that has been repeated up to this point, "I thought you would be bigger," was cut out of the scene? That's number one.
It needed to be in there.
Number two, this is an uncomfortably authentic sex scene, right? I'm like, should I be watching this? Do you think Rowdy Harrington, our beloved leader, was like, listen, if we're going to do the fight scenes real, we're doing the sex scene real. Leave the camera on. It's a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot of intimacy going on.
And then there's a guy who's outside with binoculars. Why? Like,
he's just
mad jerking off, you know, angrily.
Well, yeah, but that's an 80s trope, too, that very slow, sensual.
I guess that's true. Like, Arnold was doing it a lot, right?
Think about that. Like,
they're going after it.
I'm not going to explain how sex works, but it's a bit. You have a
Patrick Swayze ruined her. That's why you're like, why does she like him? He seems like kind of a bad boy. And she says it earlier. She's like, I know you're not a nice guy.
Right.
She's like, yeah, but he's unflappable. He knows he has a plan for everything.
Yeah.
They go after it. I can't look at it. I have to look away. It's too much. It's so bad. There's a bit where when that girl does the striptease of Wesley to show some weird power thing by making it's such a weird scene. But she takes her dress off and she throws it in his face and she has her great 80s panties. Love it. No way had any effect on me. No way. Had zero influence on me. But she does like she's like covering her top. And you're like, oh, it's chased, even though. And she grabs the guy's hat, and then she gets. But at one point, she has her hands in a classic sort of like boob cover hand bra.
Yeah.
And one of her tits is just out though.
It's not covering at all.
We know, like one of them is just out.
She's sloppy. That woman is sloppy the whole movie. She's drunk.
No, he's got her. Yeah, he's got her like numb. Like, Wesley's done something terrible to her.
Yeah.
That bit where he goes over when Wesley's trying to recruit him. And you just see her, and she's beaten. You're like, they do so. At this point, Wesley is all just like Dalton. Oh, yeah. It's stories and the idea of something more. But everyone is bad.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone is bad. I love it. That scene, because, and I think we're right next to it, is like when they show up in the monster truck. So you're like, hey, guys, there's a monster truck. They don't ever go, do you know Joey has a monster truck? You don't see the monster. You see it when Tinker and the other guy go back. It's like parked.
Right.
But somebody's like, hey, guys, there's a monster truck in this movie. Lest you forget, but they never go, hey, look at my monster truck. And I love that. I love her jazzercising.
Yes, the jazzercise.
So 80s. And she's just bruised, but it's like 2 seconds. It's like a 2-second scene. It's all nuance. Mm-hmm. It's like it does that great balance. I'm gonna just go over it.
Yes.
It does that great thing of balancing, just being like in your face. Do you see what's happening? And nuance, nuance, yep. nuance, yep. nuance. We like it's show don't tell. It's yep. show don't tell yep. as much as possible. And I love that. And even with because Wade's not there yet. I don't want to jump.
We're
ahead,
almost there. The Wade, we're just like, about there. Yeah.
When they meet and he's like, "This isn't Memphis." It's like, "What does it have to do with Memphis?" And they never talk about it again. Like they never say what happened.
Yeah.
No, we know what happened. Listen, we'll get there. We know what happened in Memphis. Or we think we do because they've established it before, but it's like show don't tell. Yep. Show don't tell. It's like I love that. Yep. Like,
they've got a history.
It's also good foreshadowing. I feel like this movie has foreshadowing that is, like you said, nuanced foreshadowing. Like the monster truck comes in later, the throat rip comes in later, the guy dying comes in later.
Yeah,
there's a lot of like little things that they make. I'm like. Perks you a little bit. You're like, why did they say that? Is that important?
And that's we'll find again, out, you this know? Is formative to me because everything matters. And the throat rip thing, I think they mention at the very, very beginning, right? But they say it like it's a tall tale.
Right.
It feels bullshit. You know what I mean? And so like little things like that, because then you find out later, because I think Wesley in the scene mentions it. Like you killed a man. I know you killed a man somewhere. I don't think he says Memphis, but we know that's what they're talking about, right? And like, well, we know, we go, oh, wait, did he kill him by ripping his throat out? Yes. Yes. But we don't know that yet. We don't know that yet, right? Show don't tell. I think show don't tell is so important. That way there's never, outside of Dalton explaining the rules, and maybe Wesley has like a couple like very hard expository lines. The exposition is natural. It's how you and I would explain a situation to each other. And I love that in storytelling. I never want someone to walk into a room and go, this is what's happening. I hate it. Because no one in my life outside of school has walked into my life and been like, this is what a thing is. You know what I mean? I love Roadhouse so much.
No wonder my students hate me.
No, here's the thing. In that setting, like it's the only setting where it's acceptable. You know, some sort of speech, a presidential speech. Right. You know what I mean? No one are a boss. And when a boss does it, you hate it. Right? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But someone walking in and going, X, 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 X. There's only a few places where it happens. But if you watch media with a critical eye, you'll see how often someone is explaining to you what's because like they're like, we got to make sure they understand, we got to make sure it's clear. And Roadhouse at no point goes, do you get it, do you understand? It's like, no, we get it. We how much is there to get? Maybe is also an argument. But but I love the nuance. It already goes, these guys are bad, these guys are good, but look, we're never going to like spell it out for you. You have to kind of I love
it. Great A classic. And so soon after that, we finally get to meet Wade Garrett. If there's anyone cooler than Dalton, again, it has to be his best buddy, who now is finally riding into town, really just in the nick of time in that moment. The unforgettable Wade Garrett, played by, of course, the legendary Sam Elliott.
Which, you know, Sam Elliott, even if you've never met him and you've just heard his voice, you know that he's the kind of guy that winks at you. You know what I mean? Like, he's definitely kind of guy who's like, had a partner, and then he winks, and you're like, I like that wink.
Someone's going to fly into my mentions and be like, you're incorrect. But this and Big Lebowski are his two best movies, right? His two best roles?
I think
so. And he's so
probably
a little. He doesn't show up, I think, until 30 minutes, 40 minutes left in the movie.
Yeah, it's toward, like, he has the call. They call, so he kind of establishes, you know, earlier in the movie, he's mentioned when, you know, Patrick Swayze says, like, he says, I want the best. He's like, Wade Garrett's the best. And we get, but when we finally rides in,
he's Dalton's Yoda.
So he's his mentor. He was the guy who showed him the ways. Right. But you say his name at the beginning. We see him again. He shows up and he says like three dope lines. Like one, he calls Patrick Swayze Miho in the coolest way anyone's ever said.
Oh
Miho.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then he goes, he's like, Morgan says one of my favorite lines in this movie, which no one talks about, where he says, mind your own business, dad, which is like the greatest delivery. It's such a good line.
So good.
And then he's like, do you want to fight? And he's like, I'm sure as heck not going to show you my dick.
And then he dick punches the guy. Like, I like
that they
finally.
Yeah, that guy, he looks like. Is that Jaws from Boston? It looks like Jaws.
He does kind of look like.
Yeah, right?
He's huge. Like, very like explicitly shows that he punches him in the dick.
It's so good. And another thing that's kind of nice about that scene is it's the first scene where you see Dalton. Like, Dalton's great, but against seven people, he can't do it. You know what I mean? Like, seven people can take him.
It's too much.
Yeah. I also, the one detail I like in that scene is that, like, so the whole point of what's happening there is that we found that Wesley has this chokehold on the bar by he controls the liquor coming into town. So Dalton somehow, because he's Dalton, he's got his connections, he's got an ender, right?
Knows the
guy's
guy.
Coming in. So the whole point of this is they're trying to interrupt the flow of liquor into this bar, right? And I like that while all these guys are beating up Dalton, like, there's one guy that's actually smart, and he's grabbing the cases of liquor and throwing them on the ground and snatching them.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, this go, like, they really only need, like, just somebody distracting him. Like, they're supposed to be, like, busting the liquor. So I like that there's at least the detail of one guy who actually knows what he's supposed to be there for. And again, then we actually get the fight, which is fantastic and a great introduction to Wade Garrett.
That guy's still doing the job that they came to do. Is it's part of what makes Roadhouse great. It's the attention to detail. It's the little things. All the little things matter. I love it.
And Wade doesn't immediately jump into action, which I love too. Yeah. He's sort of just taking it all in.
Doesn't he ask him? Do you need any help? Do you need help?
Yeah. It's so great.
Yeah, he's just it's amazing that, again, Swayze is so cool in the as Dalton. You know, Dalton is so cool. And, but then you're like, if Swayze is cool 10, like, Elliot is cool 11. Like, even cooler, even chiller.
What's interesting about those two is that Dalton is not someone you'd run into. He does not seem like a guy. Wade Garrett feels like a guy you
absolutely
know. And he's the coolest guy you know. And what's also interesting about this movie is that Wade and Dalton are not big guys.
Right.
Wade Garrett is slender and long, and you go, he's fast and he's poking at you, right? Or he's just like coming down because he's so tall. It's interesting that they're like, these are guys, and it's again very Bruce Willis. It's like, these are just kind of normal looking guys who are just very good at what they do. And what they do is they handle situations. You know what I mean? They deal with situations. Wade Garrett's so cool. When he's dancing with the duck and he's just like, dude, I was like, what do you got for me, Wade? You know what I mean? I'm going to kiss. And then when she's walking away, he's looking at her with his head cocked to the side. And he's like, he's like, she has far too many brains to have an ass like that. But here, I'm going to say, listen, that's the one moment in this movie I go, this is a work of fiction because I already saw her naked ass and that's fine. It's only okay. You know? But Wade, everything he does is everything, the way he said, and it's Sam Elliott. So of course it sounds cool. Everything like rolls out every bit, even when he's like the bit, because I think it's coming up where he's talking to Dalton about, he's like, this don't, like, why are you dealing with the past? Which is a great, they say nothing in that scene. They say everything in that scene. Even when he's not being the coolest dude in the room and he's kind of being like a good friend because he's kind of telling him what you should do, right? It still sounds cool, man. Like, everything he says sounds cool. And it's not, it's because it's Sam Elliott, but it's just well-written bits. Like, the bits are so well-written, and they just own them.
And can we talk about detail in that scene? Like, the scene where they dance? So there's a couple things. Right before that scene, that's the scene where... Is that the scene with the knife foot guy?
I believe so,
I think that's a couple scenes back. So there's the knife foot guy, and then she shows up, and they hang out all night. And then they're, like, they're drinking. And the doc is there too, who probably has to do surgery.
No, they say in the morning, they say, she's like, I guess I have to go to work. I'm going to get a couple hours sleep. She says it,
Yeah, my shift's in a couple hours. Yeah. But also, so like, they hang out all night into the morning. And what I like about Dalton is every morning he looks freaking tired. And in this scene, he looks real tired. Like, no one else looks tired. Everyone else looks fresh as a freaking daisy. Yeah. And he's like,
I thought about this today. And I'll tell you, because there's a line again, Sam Elliott owns it. It's the most generic line that every pseudo tough guy, where he goes, I'll sleep when I'm dead. But he's like, I don't need sleep. I'll get it when I'm dead. But she's an ER doctor, presumably, right? So she's never sleep. Mm-hmm. She's used to not sleeping. Right. And you just learn that maybe Wade Garrett never sleeps.
Right.
Like, he's just doing like micro sleeps, like Salvador Dali with a bell. You know what I mean? Like, he just might, like, because he's so cool, he doesn't even need to sleep. Wade Garrett, man, he's the coolest dude.
He could have taken Doc from Dalton. Like, there's no doubt.
Dude,
like,
but you know, here's the thing, though. She gives Dalton, like, the biggest tongue kiss. Like, right, just to be like,
oh, yes.
She's like, here's the thing. The thing is, like, if Wade was 10 years younger, there would be an issue here. Right. But she's like, here's the thing. Wade, you go, even at bit, you go, I'm so cool, but I respect my friend.
Right.
Everything's so nuanced, right? So he's just like,
right, well, that's one of the things when you talk about details that I love about that exchange. I just think is so endearing and tells us so much about all of their characters, that Wade runs into town, comes into town, and as soon as, you know, they finish this fight and presumably, like, Swayze gets a little, like, cleaned up, like, the first thing he does is take him to go see his girlfriend, right? But I think it's like, and then we're going to hang around. That I just think is such, like, it's a sweet thing. Again, she talks about all their characters, that, like, how close they are and how much that Swayze cares that, like, it's not just like they're hanging at a bar, like, oh, I've been seeing this chick that's a doctor. Like, no, I'm going to do it. And then even the way that he just shows up and, like, and clearly she's there. Like, it isn't like they're surprising. Like, she's ready. He has called her and said, like, hey, I'm going to pick you up.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to hang out with my friend Wade
like,
tonight.
It just says so much about, like, how much Wade means to him, how much she means to him. Like, it's great. And again, you just,
you
love all that. You love all their characters. And it, like, even with Wade coming in so late, you immediately, like, you're just bought into that. So you care about what happens after that.
It's a really great point. Like, again, just think of, like, a storytelling element. How, like, it's one thing you go, oh, my friend's coming, I've known him since we were kids. You go, oh, they're old friends. But Wade and Dalton feel like the way they talk to each other, the way they look at each other. Yeah. It's so nuanced, and they say nothing.
Absolutely.
They don't say anything. But you go, oh, these guys have known each other forever. They've been through some shit. Yeah. They love and respect and trust each other. Like, these guys are loners. Yeah. They're loners, but they care about one other person. And they do it with nothing. It's such a master class of storytelling and nuance. I just love, dude, I love Roadhouse. And I love buddy stuff. You know what I mean? Like, all these things like.
Yes.
And it does show tell. And it's so hard to do that because you have to have some restraint to do that.
Let's move forward then, right? We get Wade. And really, like, once Wade gets there, Wesley turns the intimidation up to 11. He blows up Red Shop. Then he has, again, I think we talked about this a little bit already, but really the smuggest bar hang ever, where he invades the Double Deuce with his goons, and he finally sets loose his main henchman, Jimmy.
Is the monster truck scene before or after
the monster truck? That's coming. That's part of, but first, before we finally get,
he burns Red Shop.
We get to see Jimmy, played by Marshall Teague, who's a, like, legit martial artist, has experience.
Martial arts guy. What's Red's last name?
Webster.
Red Webster, Dalton, Wade Garrett. Three great names. Emmett even is a cool name for an old guy, named, played by Sunshine Parker. Brad Wesley somehow is cool as shit. Two first names.
Right.
I don't know. And then let's bring in the big danger, the big trouble. What's his name? It's just Jimmy. It's Jimmy.
Jimmy.
You know Jimmy. Dude, what did the name? It was the right. Like, I'm done with names. I've used them all up. We're gonna call her Doc, and his name's Jimmy.
A lot of people have commented on how, like, this movie it really is a Western in a bar.
Oh, 100%.
And they talk about, like, all the names are, like,
a
lot of the names are directly from famous, like, old West villains. I mean, you got Dalton from the Dalton Gang. Wade Garrett, like, Garrett from Pat Garrett and Billy Kidd.
Yeah, from the
Doc,
Tombstone.
Like Doc Holliday.
Yeah.
Brad Wesley, like John Wesley Harding. And they said, like, that was intentional, that, like, and it really is. Like, if you could make this movie,
they wanted to make
and I would love to
Western.
See this movie in, like, an Old West saloon. Like, it could totally
be
there.
That's so interesting, because, I mean, 1000% is a Western. Like, my book, Sex Castle, which very much draws from Roadhouse, I would say if there's parents to that book, it's Shane and it's Roadhouse. Like, Shane, which
a Western. Which Shane is Sex Castle's first name, isn't it?
Very similar, right? Yeah, it's not coincidence. But, you know, like, it's also a very similar story in that someone comes to town.
Yes.
They make friends with the locals, and then they solve the town's problem. Like, it's not a new story.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, the story's not... Right. You're not there for the story. It's always how the story is told.
Exactly.
And I think if you use that metric, like, Roadhouse tells this story. So that's interesting. I'm going to give it the slide. Who's Jimmy? Who's Jimmy then? It better be like, like Doc Holliday's real
There's
name.
There's got to be someone. Yeah. I don't know. If one of our listeners.
Jimmy, though.
Jimmy's a psycho, dude. Can we talk about
the
fact that he's a psycho? He's got psycho eyes. He's just crazy. He looks, honestly, if a xenomorph
I'm
was
here for it.
Human,
yes.
That's him. Like, he's got this rapey, I'll eat you and rape you at the same time kind of face.
Got a knife boot.
On
got
him.
The knife boot going
like, on. Like Marshall Teague, by the way, Teague is perfect for this kind of movie because this movie's all about high kicks and stuff. Taekwondo is the martial art for high kicks, and he's a Taekwondo guy. So, like, he does all that stuff so well in jeans, I might add. So, like, which is not easy. So,
right.
he's just, like, I want to talk. I wish Marshall T got more screen time because
he played it so well.
He's another one, again, where they do so little, but you know, this guy is tough. You know, he doesn't boast at fighting. Yeah. Right.
And a lunatic. Like a tough lunatic. Like, I feel like he. And, you know, Dalton are on the same plane.
A spectrum. Yeah, they're the opposite of the spectrum.
Sides.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like Dalton is super, like, aware and philosophical, and yet Marshall Teague or Jimmy is the same level of skill, dark side.
Right.
Like, well, that's something, too, awesome, like, because, right, before this scene, we really haven't seen Jimmy do anything but glare and sneer, and his only lines have basically been telling... I can't even remember her name, the jazzercise queen, like basically telling her to get out of here. Like, he's pulling her around.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He comes to get her, and then that's when the monster truck, he takes her out. And this is before this scene, obviously, where Jimmy comes and wrecks the place. But yeah, he takes her out.
All right. Is that one of the scenes where we see the.
That's Boot Knife Guy, by the way.
Yes. But there's a scene where, like, Kelly, I think, or that Kelly is the actress's name, Doc and Dalton are driving around, and they're, like, tailing them, like, staking them out in the monster truck. Like, they're being inconspicuous in, like, the side of the parking lot in Bigfoot. Like, oh, yeah, that's that one. You're really hiding. Yeah. But anyway.
That scene where they show up with the boot, which I love, one, because it's another, like, look how cool. I'm moving back a little bit. But Dalton says to the guy who looks like if Horatio Sanz is a bouncer, he says... He goes, right boot. And then you see the edit of the boot, and it goes back, and he's like, got it, right? And they walk over, and he's like, sorry, fellas, this place, I love this line so much. He's like, sorry, fellas, this place is closed. And the guy's like, what are all these people doing here? And Dalton's like, oh, they're drinking and having a good time. And he's like, well, maybe I came to have a good time, too. And Dalton says, you're too stupid to have a good time.
Yes. Thank you for bringing that back.
That's so good.
Dude, if he was in fourth grade, he would have devastated. Right.
Yes. Not devastated. He is too stupid to have a good time.
Oh, so great.
You're too stupid to have a good time.
Oh, yeah. And when he fights him with the boot, what's great is he catches the boot. He catches the boot. He tosses the guy out. And then outside, when the guy engages with the boot again, he takes it off and throws it on the roof. And I'm like, you're a genius. Yeah. You're a genius.
Right. But I love, again, when we finally see Jimmy show off his pool cue foo. I mean, he's legit, right? We know that he is legit as a martial artist. Yeah. But
he's kind of the first martial arts that, like pure. Yes. And as a movie fan, as an American movie fan, you know, kung fu defeats normal fighting. Kung fu, that's paper, scissors, rocks, right? You know what I mean?
Right.
And like, if American just normal punching is paper or rocks, then this is the paper. Like, you know it. It's shorthand.
Right.
We go, oh, here's this guy's trouble.
My favorite detail in that fight, though, is that he does what really feels like the most unnecessary thing ever. He uses the pool cue to pole vault onto the stage. And when Nolan steps up to him, he just jumps off the stage. I was like, why did you even do that?
He was in the flow, man.
You know exactly why he did it.
Yeah.
Flair. Yeah. Like, Taekwondo is a pretty flary martial art.
He was feeling himself, man. He was feeling himself.
Yeah.
Also, Dalton is just kind of, I guess they fight, but they let the fight start for a while before they get involved.
So the fight starts, and then they get involved, and then Wade fights Jimmy.
Oh, that's
right. Yeah. He's getting whooped.
When he's on the stage, he's like, Dalton. He says, Wade, like, Dalton, when he's on the stage. And Dalton, they turn and they have like a very, where they're both like this. They're frozen. Like they're, huh? Like they do, everyone in the fight stopped. Huh? Which I love. I love it. But it's like such a bit. It's such a bit to have everyone stop. Everyone, like, no one's fighting in the background. Everyone has stopped because he yelled Dalton's name.
Well, right. He fights Wade, then he shoots. That's like, I think when he shoots into the air, and that's like right after, like basically Red's shop is in flames because they like they all ran out and then they come back and these guys are in the bar. And I think it's at that moment, that's where I first noticed the like there's no cops. I like there's a building on fire. This guy has just discharged a firearm inside this bar. Like, where are the cops? Like, is there no cops? And, right.
He owns them. Yeah. 80, it's plot armor. It's 80, wearing, you know, like, let's face it. He's just wearing plot armor. Like
everything like that, you build your villain. Like, it's one thing if they do, it's one thing if someone does bad things. It's one thing if one's willing to do more vicious things physically. But this goes, like, not only is he kind of a psychopath, and he's going to do whatever he wants for his own gains. He can.
Right.
Like, that's what it sets up. So you're like, wouldn't it be easier if there's cops around? Like, listen, they shouldn't have shown up at the end, honestly. They shouldn't have shown up at the end because it invites, like, well, hold on. Do they still work for him?
Do they
still work? But the handgun, him shooting the gun, does the same thing that Jimmy does.
Yeah.
What beats Kung Fu? A gun. Wesley has the thing. So it's paper, rock, scissors, right? And so when we've only seen people fighting. Here's a guy who's beating people with a pool cue, which is a little escalation. Right. But really, his kung fu, we go, this guy's on his own, even though none of us are doubting that Dalton can take him. No one doubts it because we've seen him. But Wesley goes, I'm just a normal guy who hasn't punched anyone. I have a gun. It creates a lane for the character.
But we do get, I know we've mentioned a few times, again, Wesley continues in trying to push Dalton out of town. He continues to destroy the town by, we get the unforgettable scene at the car dealership where we finally get to see Bigfoot set loose on the car dealership, which is so 80s, right? Mm-hmm. Man, I forget, like, remember when monster trucks were awesome?
Yeah, it was 1989. It was 1989 when this...
I had a Bigfoot truck. Was there a Bigfoot cartoon?
Yes, there was. Yeah. There's two things about that scene that I like a lot. One, Emmett, the old man Emmett, starts to run to, like, he's going to do something, and they have to hold him back. He still has the overall. He has the same outfit on. He's like, Emmett, what are you going to do? They already pulled the guy who owns the place. Two, so... This scene is it's such a set piece, right? It's such a great set piece where, because it says so much about Wesley, but also it's one of those things like, you guys know how in like Mallrats there's a monkey at the end because they had budget death? This is the biggest budget moment of the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like, did they have the budget or did they write it in and be like, listen, we can't cut the monster truck scene? Because it's such a beautiful 80s spectacle. It's perfect.
Absolutely.
Seeing it, like, it goes through those windows, those giant dealer windows. It goes over the car. There's people inside. Yes. There's just normal people trying to buy a Chrysler inside that has a month. Like, Wesley's out of control, man. Like, he's not even worried about that. He couldn't even send Jimmy in to be like, guys, you might want to get out of here. We're about to do something crazy. You know, the boss is making an example of this guy. You might want to make some space.
Right.
Insane. And I love that scene.
You know, and for one, if you didn't get the point that he owns the town and owns the supposed police, like, if they didn't show up when Red's house was, or Red's shop was blown up, like, broad daylight, store with custody, you could just do this and no cops. Yeah.
That scene goes, in case you had any doubts, he can do whatever he wants, whenever he wants. So it's like, if people are going to die. Like, it changes the stakes. Before, you're like, this guy seems kind of petty and mean.
Yeah.
Now he's like, listen, in story, I can do whatever I want in this town. Literally. There's nothing you can be done about it. And it raises the stakes. It raises the stakes.
And that's where you really see the carrot, like, Dalton's friends kind of turn from being like, we're here to support you, to everyone's basically like, get the fuck out of here.
Get out of town.
You need to leave. Like, Wade... And the doc, like, you can't do that. You need to leave.
There's that great when Garrett does the, oh, you're stuck in the past or whatever. And Dalton goes, fuck it, let's just get out of here. It's such a good scene because that's in no other movie. There's no other movie where the hero in the midst of this action spectacle goes, fuck this, let's just get out. We don't need this.
Yeah, I mean, he's a hired gun in a way. Like,
you feel like, oh, I understand why he wants to stay here because there's all these great people here that aren't under or, you know, that don't want to be under Wesley's thumb. Like,
what's great is like, he came to do a job for the money, the amount of money that he said, which, by the way, I think was $500 a day, which is a lot.
Side comment, and I tried to find out information on this, I still haven't. I would love if anyone listens. So the amount of money that he's getting paid, if you calculate the 5,000 in and then 500 a day, supposedly, I was an English major, I'm not a math guy. But it's something I'd read online said that if you equate what that would be over a year, to money now, that is equivalent to roughly $500,000. What I want to know is, jeez, like, are there any bouncers or bar head of security anywhere that gets paid that much money?
Well, he's not going to be there for a year, though. Presumably,
right?
Yeah,
right, right.
Or like some political bar in D.C. where everyone. But in here, the reason why you agree is because, you know, he's the melting man. Right. Says, like, I came in with some money, but presumably Dalton's only going to be there for what, 2 months, 8 right. weeks. Yeah.
Right.
So the thing with these characters, like, what's so great is good that point, Dalton goes, I'm going to come, I'm going to do the job they hired me to do, I'm going to fix this thing, and I'll go to the next place. He's bar rescue. It is. That's right. His bit. He goes to where, if they're going to offer him the money, he'll go there. And probably after this, he's like, I'll go back to that place in Wisconsin that I like. You know what I mean?
Right.
But he's only going to be there for a little bit. And the thing is like, the problem is he likes these people. He likes Emmett. He likes Doc. He likes the people
he's at down.
The yes. Yeah. So the thing is like, that's why you go, it's the thing for us as viewers to be invested is like, why doesn't he just leave? Like, who gives a shit? Outside of we know, and it's not true for Dalton because he says, I'm not a nice guy. He never says like morally, I'm morally white, morally black, right? So we know he's maybe not the best guy, though. He's great. Listen, we fucking love him. Dalton gives best. He gives the best Christmas presents, and we all fucking know it. but that's the bit is like he. It's not just a matter of. I think there is. We get the impression that he will do a job. Like, he's the kind of guy when he starts something, he finishes it. He comes across like that. Wade Garrett comes across like that. These are guys who finish things they start, right? Which is also a generic tough guy thing. But why doesn't he leave? Because he's falling for Doc, who's great. She's great on paper. She's perfect. She's a doctor. She's hot. She's a good lay. Clearly, we all can see that, right? She's cool. Like, she's cool because if you start to pull your pants down as a stranger, she's like, wow. She's cool. Like, there's all these things. So you go.
Right.
That's what. Even then, for him to go, screw this, we're out. That's another big thing. Like, that's a big moment because they're loners, but he's falling for this town. Yeah, it's so good.
So after the car dealership, there's the moment where, and they set it up really nicely, where the doc goes over to his house and basically says, like, get the hell out of here. Why are you staying? Like, there's no reason you should stay.
Yeah.
And then Emmett's house gets blown up. And this is really where everything reaches a crescendo, where we see Emmett's house in flames, Jimmy Evil laughing, riding his very 80s motorbike. And now we see is the time for Dalton to not be nice.
Yeah, screaming into the night.
Tackles him off his bike. Yeah.
That motorcycle is like the one from Grease 2, isn't it? Like, it's like...
And that, right, then we get the fight. And we get what has to be what this movie is most remembered for.
You think so? Maybe.
I don't know.
You know what I love about this fight is that the buildup is so nice. And then this fight's like, what, 4 moves? Like, it's over so fast.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's brutal. These guys are fighting there's no question when that fight starts after the house, it's burning in the background, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's like they're fighting to the death now. Like, it's
right.
Swayze has lost his goddamn mind, and this psychopath is coming.
Yes, yes.
By the way, Swayze lost his eloquence, too. I noticed his one line was fall by the way.
He goes crazy.
Like, you're such an asshole. Right. Yeah. You know, I'm like, wow, that, like, you don't have the wherewithal to be like, use your cool, like, opinions differ. Yeah. No, he's like, you're an asshole. Like, he's reduced down to an angry middle schooler.
This was him before. This is what Dalton once was. He was Jimmy, right? He was this mindless fighting machine until probably he met Wade Garrett, who's like, you should go to school. You should go to check out philosophy. I'm serious. Like, he is cool. Like, not because he was always cool. This is something that, because you got to be ready for everything. And so this version, I think this is the version that he's keeping in check through the whole movie, right? And he gets to unleash it. And we have the craziest fight sequence.
Now I feel like if they were going to do, I wish this new Roadhouse movie was make it like a prequel.
Dude.
And have it set back in the early 70s, right? And have it be Dalton be that guy. Wade comes in and now we see how does he become the Dalton that we love.
It's one of two things, and if you were like, we're doing a prequel Roadhouse with Jake, cool, let's see it. You either do when Wade and Dalton first met, or you do whatever happened in Memphis, which is when he killed a man by ripping out his throat. Like, it's one of those two things is the Roadhouse that I go, let me see this. When you go, we're going to remake something that's a unicorn.
Right.
Like, you can't do it. Like, guys, we've got 2 Willy Wonka remakes now. Like, you can't do it. you can't recreate what Gene Wilder did. You can't do it.
Right,
you can't recreate what Swayze does in this movie and what Wade Garrett does. And frankly, what Brad Wesley does, what all these characters do. I'm so excited about this moment.
Yeah, we get to this unforgettable moment in the fight where Dalton shows what has been foreshadowed to us several times earlier in the movie. We finally see it. Dalton's ultimate finishing move. Dr. Dom, I hope that this means this is what our science segment is.
With science!
Yes, science!
Science!
It's not rocket science! Just say yes and we'll move on!
Science!
I don't think science knows, actually.
Blinded me! With science!
So I still feel that the throat rip is the most famous thing in this movie, because like the martial arts, like we said, it's mostly haymakers and, you know, like side kicks and crotch kicks. And then of course you got some cool taekwondo with Jimmy, but the throat rip's awesome. So I'm going to kind of dissect, pun intended, what the throat rip is. We'll talk about what the throat and a whole thing. So I'll say what he does and then I'll circle back. What he does is he does basically tiger claw kung fu. So you notice how he has like his open hand with the bent fingers? That's tiger claw. All right. It's a style of kung fu where your open hand, it's a lot of slashing and also jabbing with the fingertips. And in the movie, essentially what he does is he manages to hit with such force that his fingertips are able to go through the skin, wrap around portions of the anterior front of the neck. So we'll circle back to that later, but let's talk about what we're dealing with anatomically speaking. So it's not really the throat, to be perfectly honest. Your throat is technically your pharynx, which is like the back of your mouth area. So what's located in the front of your neck is, of course, skin, fascia, muscle, blood vessels. You got your thyroid gland and some other stuff. But the real part is the one portion of the lower respiratory system, your windpipe. Mm-hmm. The beginning of your windpipe. So you have your larynx, which is your voice box. So some of your larynx is right in at your chin area, but the rest of it goes to that open area at your neck. And then it transitions into your trachea, which is just a pipe that brings air down to other pipes called bronchi and other pipes called bronchioles. And they eventually go to your lung alveoli, which is where gas is exchanged, and then the air comes back out. So clearly it's important.
Yeah.
Right? And you can feel that. So anyone, and everyone has an Adam's apple, even if you can't see it. Everyone who touches their throat, they can feel their Adam's apple. That is the thyroid cartilage, not the gland, the cartilage, which is a big shield of cartilage with a bump in the middle. So that's basically part of that pipe, the voice box part of the pipe that's going down, right? And it's funny because injuries to that area are actually kind of rare. So your larynx being injured is pretty rare. And the reason is because even though there's not a lot of tissue between, you know, the larynx and the trachea and just outside, you have your jaw and your sternum. And if you just tuck your chin, it's blocked. So if you just, like, when you tuck your chin, if you ever feel threatened, you lower your chin, nothing's going to get to it. So the fact that it's open really doesn't make it super susceptible, because you can block it really easily. So typical injuries are people that get clotheslined by something and don't realize it, or a car accident, or they get their head whipped back and then something comes forward, which are rare occurrences because it's easy to block it.
And like instinctually, know? Probably too, right? Instinctually, you always kind of...
Yeah, so it's very instinctual. Just the first thing you do is when something gets towards you, you throw your hands up and you put you tuck your chin. Tuck your chin when you fall, you tuck your chin. Tucking your chin is a very common thing, so injuring that part is not an easy thing to do unless it's an extenuating circumstance or someone's not resisting. So first of all, since we're talking about tiger claw, tigers actually kill their prey with throat attacks. They don't kill their prey with their claws. They take their claws to drag the prey down. And then what they do is they wrap their mouth around the neck and squeeze, and that collapses the pipe. Okay. And that's how they kill their prey. Lions do it. Big cats, tigers do it. Big cats do it a lot. So it's funny that he uses tiger claw to kill someone when tigers use their teeth to kill someone that way. But anyway, humans, you got the what we call affectionately in jiu-jitsu the rape choke, which is where you wrap your hands around the person's neck and you push into their larynx and trachea with your thumbs. That's actually not hard to defend against. If you're standing up, you can just step backwards. If you're against the wall, you can just turn. Also, the person's using two hands, so you can just like punch them in the face and rip their ear off and stuff like that. People get, you can punch them in the throat if you're fast enough. Karate likes to use an open palm strike where you use the webbing of your hand and go jab it in there. And that's enough. And because you're coming up, that is a good way to totally like shock a person, even if you don't do any damage, and they'll step back.
It's interesting because you like throat in the eyes, right? But the throat is hard to get to. It's a hard shot. And like, what are you going to do? Like, maybe they choke. Like it seems like the eyes make sense, because if you get those, you're screwed. But the throat, if you don't get it just right, it's just a weird hit, right? It's just a weird punch.
Exactly. And that's actually a good point. So if you're going to attack the neck, you should do a blood choke, which is what we do in judo and jiu-jitsu. And typically you have to secure the person first, and it's a whole thing, right? Tiger Claw, what he does is he manages to pull the guy's head back so his throat is exposed, which, as you said, is a rarity in a fight, because that's gonna hard to do. Like, how do you take a grown man and pull their head back unless they're pretty much unconscious? So essentially you're kind of, you know, it's kind of cold-blooded in a way, which is the whole point. He's like, I'm gonna kill you, you know. So anyway, he goes down with his fingertips, punctures through the skin with his fingertips, manages to weave his fingers around the muscles in your neck, which are called the sternocleidomastoids, wrap his hands around the larynx and trachea, and pull it out, which is very hard to do. Also, guess what? The larynx is attached to your hyoid bone, which is attached to your tongue. So you'd have to separate it from a muscular tongue.
Yeah, I don't buy it either.
I don't buy it. I've seen a lot of people say it's pure fiction, the idea that you can manage to. I've never heard of a person taking their fingertips and being able to puncture through someone's skin. Now, if he had like razor fingers, he could cut through or some weird thing like that. But like, he just has fingers. It's just fingers, right? So the only thing I've seen to support this actually working is there's this show called Fight Science, where someone does the move to ballistics gel. Now, ballistics gel has the density of mammal muscle, but it doesn't have that resistance elasticity to it. So basically you're grabbing tough jello.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, even though in Fight Science it looks really cool, I don't buy that it would work in. But like I said, it's too heterogeneous in an actual human for me to buy that you could go in. Now, he could collapse his trachea, his larynx. That shit will get the job done.
Yeah.
But the rip, I don't buy it.
Isn't there, like, the carotid or whatever in there a major blood source also, like, right there, too?
Yeah, but that's carotid's really hard to get to. Like, it's deep in there. Like, you can put pressure on it and knock the guy out. That happens all the time. Or you can cut it. I mean, there was a famous hockey player got cut with a skate in his carotid. That's awful. So, yeah, cutting the throat, that works. But we're talking about bare hand, nubby terminal unguals. terminal phalanges going in there. No, it's not going to happen.
Here's the thing. It doesn't matter. The flying guillotine is awesome. When you do fights, it can just be cool. It doesn't matter if it's real. I remember watching a million action movies with my dad, and someone would shoot someone with a shotgun. They go flying off, and my dad would go, "That's not what happens." And I'm like, "Yeah, but it's not as cool looking. Who gives a shit? We're not watching a reality show. We're watching a fictitious display of violence. Like, give it to me. Like, I want the geyser of blood. Not always, but sometimes I want the geyser of blood. What's interesting that I never thought about from what you just said, which I think is like all these things are actually attached to other things, and how hard it would be, even if you could get into the first thing. How hard it would be to actually yank it out is like really interesting to me, because there's too many things attached to things.
Right.
That's interesting. That was great. Yeah, I love that. Thank you so much for that. That was awesome.
I love it. That was fantastic. You know, and I wonder in this moment when it happens, I love that he does it, like right in front of the doctor. Like she comes running up just to see the hand tracheotomy happen.
As that happens,
and I wonder
right.
if there's like part of it that even though she's obviously horrified because she's a good person and a doctor, but I wonder if there's like some professional curiosity.
She looks. This looks just like the cadaver from medical school.
Well, she does inspect him, right?
Yeah, she tries to do her job. She tries to save him.
Yeah, she's a doctor.
Yeah.
They set it up in that first meeting at the doctor's office is that she fixes bodies and he breaks them. They are star-crossed lovers. They're from two different sides and they should not come together, but they do because it's a magical love story. There's that bit after he kills him where Dalton is dragging Jimmy's bleeding out of his neck into the lake and screaming across.
And screaming
Westy. It's a good scene. It's so well shot. Shout out to Rowdy Harrington.
Right, it's the opposite. We've seen him come undone. I mean, as we mentioned before, he's just yelling. He's like, Wesley, fuck you!
Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah, and he's not running after the girl. And I can't think of any other, like, 80s hero getting this unhinged. Like, he's not running after the girl trying to make it better. Like, no, he's gone.
Right.
Like, it's so intense.
Well, what's he supposed to do? Run up to her and be like, he was like, I'm sorry. Wait, hold his trachea for me. I have to talk to you.
You know, and it gets us to the, which is just such a wild moment. So after this, he's ready. He's checked out. You know, he gets the Mercedes and he's like, time to check out of town. So goes back to the bar. That's where we get that phone call. And it's kind of sad to me because really at this point, like, well, and he even tells Wade, he's like, Wesley won. It's over. We're getting the hell out of here. Like, Wesley doesn't need to do anything else. Like, he's won. This guy's leaving. The town is his. So when he goes back to the bar, that's when he gets the call. I'm going to flip a coin.
Insane. One of your friends is going to die. You pick. And he's like, you're a crazy man. He's like, all right, I'll flip a coin. So good. Wesley escalates. Yeah. He's losing it all because of two things, right? This guy has got the girl that he couldn't get, which is infuriating. And this guy is doing whatever he wants in Wesley's town. And it's just like each time you see Wesley, he's worse.
Yep.
He's just falling apart. And he's like, he has no, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's great. So we get, then Wade comes, Wade's alive. So we have the.
But he'd been worked over, right? He'd been worked over.
Right. So he goes to see the doctor. Yes.
She's like, what's up?
Right. I watched you kill the man.
He's looking at x-rays. As a doctor, her job is literally when you find a person dying or dead. And by the way, I'd like to add another thing. If you rip out a person's throat, even if you could do that, it's not instant for them to die. He wouldn't just be dead. He would just die. He'd be like, and he'd be sitting there writhing in agony at least for a few minutes, maybe longer. So she would probably be like, oh my God, we need to get him to a hospital. And then if he was dead, she's like, we need to call the police. Not bye-bye. So she's like, you're a psycho. I didn't call the cops. Go away.
Again, Wesley could have won. It could be all over. But no, he, in fact, kills Wade and unleashes the full fury of the Dalton. Now, all guns blaze towards Castle Wesley.
I don't think he thought he was going to live. Like, he destroys his Mercedes. His Mercedes was like his anchor. And he's like, you know what? Fuck it.
He
drives the exploding Mercedes in. Kaboom.
Right, I love he drives it with the knife, right, that was in Wade. I mean, one, let's talk about the, like, unhinged look on Swayze's face. He's just, like, shaking, and you're like, oh, this guy's fucked now.
Acting! Here's the thing. Who are we supposed to believe actually killed Wade? You know what I mean?
How did that happen?
Jimmy's the only guy who could have done it, and you were just fighting him. You know, like, I don't know.
Goons.
Yeah. I'm going to say to me, in many ways, the moment that Jimmy dies is the end of the movie. Everything after that feels like epilogue.
Well, and it's wild to think that all this stuff happens after, and all the, like, him invading Wesley's home is
classic.
All after this.
Yeah, he goes full commando.
So it's great. You have the let me fight through your bad guys classic. There's great fight sequences. Here's the thing I don't like about this end, and I'm not saying it doesn't make any sense. But why is Wesley like, I'm going to 1v1 this dude who just killed Jimmy? And the explanation they do, again, Roadhouse is perfect. They give you explanation. He says, I thought it would be fun to fight you. But listen, What are we supposed to think about Wesley at this point? The thing is, like, we know they're both falling apart, so it's like it's fine. But why is he trying to fight him? It's insane. And as I was rewatching, as I said, ego for sure. But he thinks that, like, we know he's not ego. Dumb. Though then again, we don't know he's not dumb. It's never he never does anything really smart. But what's interesting to me is I'm watching this movie and he's fighting him, and I'm like, you're an idiot. Like, why would you think this? He's like, I thought it would be fun. Right after that, he gets shot 3 times with shotgun, and he's still standing up. So I'm like, fuck, maybe he had a chance. You know what I mean? Like, maybe Wesley's not showing me what he's got, you know?
Right. Well, I thought about, well before this, before the epic lake fight, he blows up Emmett's house. Like, why didn't he just blow up the barn? Like, if he blew up the barn, then his problem solved. The guy's dead.
Because, yeah, ego.
Ego. You know, ego, and also the lady will die because he wants the lady alive. There was no coin flip.
I think, you know what? I think there was, because only because I think his whole thing is like he's becoming more and more unhinged also. So for him it's a very Batman villain thing, right? Which I know, Two-Face, yes. But I mean, it's like it's a crazy thing to be like, I don't even care. I'm just going to do this thing, and it doesn't matter to me anymore. But if you accept that as the thing, then yeah, he probably would have blown up everything. But where's he getting the explosives from? Maybe the guy wasn't good at it. Like, who knows, you know? He obviously wanted Jimmy to kill him. Like, he obviously wanted Jimmy to kill him. So this gets him out. There's all these variables.
Yeah, but it's okay because you get a lot of things. So you get the typical movie thing where the good guy is kind of worn down from beating up all the henchmen.
Got the edge.
And then the bad guy is stalking him, and he monologues while he's stalking him. How many movies do that? Like a gazillion movies. Yeah, the bad guy's walking around totally giving away where he is just so he can monologue before his inevitable loss to the hero, which we get. But not without him being shot first and yada, yada, yada.
Well, and I love this also has a moment that you nodded at in Sex Castle with the polar bear falls on poor Tinker and later drops that line that's in Sex Castle. The polar bear fell on me.
The thing that's so great is like the polar bear falling on him is not the great bit. It's him going because the police show up, right? And they're like, what happened? Right. And he's like, I didn't see anything. The polar bear fell on me. That's the great line. Also, that they wrap it up so succinctly because it's like everyone just killed a man and the police show up and they're like, they're like, we didn't see shit. No one saw anything. Right. It's like, oh, all right, everyone go home. Go have sex in the lake with the doc.
And that is it. That is I love that it ends in like a whole town murder. Like Red collects all the guns, hides them, and then we finally see the cops. It's great.
It's like that Agatha Christie. You know what I mean? Who killed them? Everyone at the end killed them, you know?
Yeah. It takes a village.
So good. I love Roadhouse. I could talk about it forever. Guys, if you like Roadhouse and you want more, check out my book Sex Castle. It's my first book from Image. Yes. It's very good. I highly recommend it.
Please do. Kyle, again, thank you for joining us. Oh, man, this movie is great. I'm glad we had you. For our listeners, where can they find you? What are kind of the projects out they should be looking for?
I'm at The Kyle Starks on all media. Currently, I have Pine and Merrimack coming out, which is kind of a cozy, escalating mystery book. This summer, I have a book coming out from First Second called Karate Prom. It's about a karate prom. That might interest your readers very much. It's from First Second. It's kind of all ages, but it's my stuff. It's just there's no curse words. That's really the only difference. And we're reprinting Rock Candy Mountain, which was my basically my second book, which is a kung fu hobo epic. I got a bunch coming out this year, man, but I just can't announce it. Like, I have so many. I was doing 7 books at the end of last year, so I have a bunch of stuff coming out. But Karate Prom, for your readers, would like Kill Them All, Sex Castle, and I think Rock Candy Mountain, too.
Awesome.
The books are out there because it's why I like coming out here because you guys are action movies fans. I love action movies. It's in my work. I think if you love action movies, then it's not. You'll like my comics. You'll like especially all the early comics. So I think we've been doing this for 5 hours, maybe too long for a podcast. So thank you guys for having me. Literally anytime.
Yes.
Maybe we'll talk about the Roadhouse remake. Who fucking knows?
Ooh,
All right. But let's take care. I'll talk to you guys later.
Again, thank you, Kyle, for joining us. To all our listeners, thank you again for tuning in to another episode of Once Upon a Time in the 80s. We're excited for you to check out even more fun times with 80s classics ahead. To keep up to date on this new season, make sure you're following us on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, TikTok, Facebook. It's at Punches and Popcorn on all those. And again, for even more fun, make sure you're checking out our partner shows on the Lunch Door Podcast Network. Shows like Food About Town, Behind the Glass, Level Up, Behind the Studio Door, Mind of Magnus, and of course, Anomaly Film Festival. Check them all out. And until next time, all right, good night.
This has been a presentation of the Lunchador Podcast Network.